When I was working on my dissertation about the 17th century female prophets, Antoinette de Bourignon, I drew extensively on a collection of letters now in the Bodleian Library, a correspondence I came across by a roundabout route. During my research in the Koninklijke Bibliotheek, the Royal Library in The Hague, I discovered an intriguing inventory, a handwritten list, 18 pages long, of, quote, some manuscripts, items, letters, papers of Antoinette de Bourignon and her friends, lodged in the library of the Enschede Publishing House in Haarlem, referring to four parcels. And here you see the first page of those 18 pages, giving a description of all those letters, short summaries. There was, however, no trace of the documents themselves in the accompanying file. The Enschede Library, it transpired, had been auctioned off in 1607, and the collection might well have been sold on again after that, or possibly even lost. I knew I was looking for a needle in a haystack, but I decided to approach the search systematically and to begin by trawling through the manuscript catalogues of the major European libraries. Very optimistic, but I was astonished and delighted when I struck gold almost straight away, already on my first day. In the manuscript catalogue of the Bodleian Library in Oxford, under manuscripts addenda A9697, I found the following description: works, correspondence, and miscellaneous papers of Antoinette de Bourignon. When I was handed the papers in question, as I sat in Duke Humphrey's library, the real Valhalla for lovers of early rare books and valuable manuscripts, the inventory bound with them left no room for doubt. This was the collection of manuscripts I was looking for, because it included the same inventory in the same handwriting. It was a copy of the lists which I had seen in The Hague. Suddenly, I had access to hundreds of original transcripts of Bourignon's letters that had never been consulted before. And what makes the collection even more interesting is that it proved to contain a number of previously unknown letters to Bourignon from the eminent 17th century Dutch naturalist Jan Swammerdam. And in fact, he was the one who copied most of the letters in the collection, which is now in the Bodleian Library. So that's very, very interesting. The collection in the Bodleian Library is a magnificent supplement to the surviving bundles of copies of Bourignon's writings that are now in Amsterdam University Library. Those are manuscripts who were edited during the publishing process. The copies, and they too include many transcripts of letters. Most of Bourignon's writings are what are known as epistolary publications, and systematic comparison of the manuscripts and the printed versions has not only thrown up a great deal of new information about the way her writings were prepared for the press, it had also led to the fundamental realignment of the prevailing image of Antoinette de Bourignon. As we shall see, the medium of the letter, and more importantly, the way Bourignon was able to make use of it, were crucial elements in the shape and substance of her spiritual leadership. But before I go into this in more depth, let me first introduce Antoinette de Bourignon. Oh, here she is. She was one of the many prophetic figures who settled down in Amsterdam in the 17th century. She was born on the 13th of January 1616 in Leeuw, which at that time was still part of the southern Netherlands, but it was a French-speaking environment. Antoinette grew up in a prosperous bourgeois family. Her father was a merchant, and she must have received the education deemed appropriate for her class and sex. Her own wish was to enter one of the many new orders that had sprung up in her native city, but her parents refused to pay the necessary dowry because they saw greater advantage in marriage. And when she was 18, Antoinette decided to run away from home to escape this fate. In her autobiography, La Parole de Dieu, The Word of God, written in 1663, she wrote that when she was about 18 years old, Saint Augustine had appeared to her in a vision and commanded her to restore his order. That was just before she fled from her parents. And this marked the start of a spiritual quest that would ultimately bring her to a critical and independent position with regard to the Roman Catholic Church and ecclesiastical authority. In December 1667, Antoinette Bourignon went to Amsterdam with a friend, Father Christian de Kort. Her life now took an entirely new turn. In Amsterdam, she could publish her writings freely without having to submit them to the church censor first. She started already writing. This was the first time she had come out in public. In 1669, she even bought her own printing press so that she did not have to be dependent on commercial printers. Her ideas about her own mission gained new impetus from her encounters with representatives of other religious persuasions. In Amsterdam, she met for the first time of her life Calvinists, Mennonites, Lutherans, Jews, and other male and female prophets, and she discussed with all those persons. She even met Comenius, and she had several meetings and discussions with him as well. Bourignon began to realize how divided the Christendom of her day was and how far some had strayed from God's truth, and this led her to emphasize above all the importance of religious practice. Membership of a religious denomination was not, in her view, a requirement for attaining eternal salvation. A Christian way of life was. The example for all of us should be Jesus Christ, according to her. With her call for an ecumenical community, avant la lettre, Bourignon succeeded in gathering around her a group of followers whom she recruited across the boundaries of the churches and for whom she acted as a spiritual leader. The sort of people who were receptive to her message were those in a spiritual crisis who could no longer find any refuge in the existing churches. Most of them were men. Given Bourignon's views about the female sex, this was not surprising. She expected to find true Christians among men rather than women, because in her view they had more courage and greater certainty of being reborn in the spirit of Jesus Christ. Bourignon declared that the community of what she called true Christians should be established on the island of Nordstrand, off the west coast of Schleswig-Holstein in the northern part of Germany near Denmark. It was home, and the island was home to Calvinists, Lutherans, and Roman Catholics living side by side, and she had bought up and inherited a number of estates there. From 1671 onwards, she made several attempts to settle in Nordstrand herself, but the community she was striving for failed to materialize. Conflicts with the Lutheran ministers, who were profoundly suspicious of her, constantly compelled Bourignon to move on. Eventually, in September 1680, she decided to return to Amsterdam. She died just before she arrived there. She was 64 years old. Bourignon left a sizable body of work, 46 works in French. There's a lot of books. This huge output sets Bourignon apart from the late medieval and early modern mystics in whose footsteps, up to a point, she trod. Unlike theirs, Bourignon's central message was located in the writing itself, undertaken at God's command, rather than in a mystic lifestyle. In her case, therefore, it was not so much the physical body from which Her Holiness or Divine Speech had to be read, but her writings that constituted the evidence of it. A great deal of Bourignon's oeuvre was translated into Dutch and German and published in her lifetime, and some of her works were also translated into Latin, though she couldn't read Latin herself. After her death, Pierre Poiret, who joined Bourignon in 1676, took it upon himself to publish such of her letters and writings as had not yet appeared in print. He was also instrumental in getting the renowned Amsterdam publisher Hendrik Wettstein to bring out a complete and unabridged reissue of Bourignon's collected works in 1685. At the end of the 17th century, as a result of Poiret's publicity campaign, the Scottish theologian George Gordon became interested in Bourignon's writings and translated several of her works into English. They did not go unchallenged, and many years after Bourignon's death, a series of publications in English appeared, taking a stand against Antonia Bourignon and Bourignonism, as it was called. As we have seen, the majority of Bourignon's published works took the form of letters. 11 different editions of her letters came out during her lifetime. Another 9 volumes containing previously unpublished letters were published posthumously. Altogether, almost 1,200 letters written in French appeared in print, most of which were also published in Dutch, German, and later English translations. A small proportion of these letters can be regarded as business correspondence. These are the letters in which Bourignon defended her claims on Nordstrand against the relevant legal authorities and other interested parties. Most of them can best be described as spiritual letters, letters in which Bourignon set herself up as the prophet sent by God to gather the true Christians whom she and she alone could show the way to eternal salvation. Now, on account of its semi-private nature, the letter was seen as the ideal means of expression for women. It was a personal medium, not dependent on a publisher for its dissemination. It also enabled the sender to strike a personal note and at the same time set out a discourse that went beyond the sharing of private matters. Bourignon must have been aware from the outset of the opportunities the epistolary genre presented. In September 1668, when she began to publish, she wrote to her companion, Christian de Kort, quote, "I have not progressed with my books, but I have written various other things which it is suggested might be printed in the manner of letters." This is an intriguing remark that merits further investigation, particularly in the light of the strategies pursued by women in the 17th century in order to make themselves heard. Might these have been fictitious letters? Marthe van der Does, you'll find her name, who published a thesis on Bourignon's life and work in 1974, touched only obliquely on this question. Before I started my research into Bourignon, I knew there were already a lot of monographs published on her. This one of Marthe van der Does, but there are several others. There are also chapters in books, a lot of articles, even 3 novels. But none of these authors had used manuscripts. And, well, we will see that using the manuscripts turns the traditional image of Antoinette Bourignon the other way around. Van der Does simply assumed that most of the letters were written to non-existent people. This assertion, whose implications Van der Does herself does not appear to have thought through, would seem to suggest that the epistolary genre was primarily a rhetorical device for Bourignon, and that her epistolary works were actually collections of fictitious letters. I'll show you. Try to. Show you an example, thanks to Google Books, who has digitalized some of the English prints of Bourignon's works. I can show you a part of it, and you see here, to the same person, for his particular perfection, and then she addresses him as my dear child, but, well, same person, all the same person, but sometimes she, well, I tried to open it on a different page, but that's not easy. Here to a friend who was in danger of letting himself be imposed upon by false appearances of virtue, and then she's addressing him as sir. And you see above it says letter and then the number, and below it gives a date, a place, and then her name. Now the problem, of course, is how real is real. In a study of in a study of 17th century epistolary poems that appeared in print, the Dutch scholar Riet Schenkeveld van der Dussen pointed out that different degrees of realness are possible. Might this also apply to Bourignon's epistolary publications? With a view to the question of the construction of a spiritual network, however, it's extremely important to comprehend the degree of realness and to find out whether and to what extent her letters were conceived for real correspondence. It therefore makes sense to examine Bourignon's epistolary publications rather more closely in terms of their formal characteristics. The salutation and signature aside, the printed letters show all the signs of being authentic. In the first sentence, for example, there's often mention of a letter that has been received, as well as the date. There are then usually also references to points contained in the letter in question. References of this kind are typical of the genre. Letter writers use them to confirm that they have understood their correspondence. Another striking feature is that Bourignon used several different forms of address, as well as monsieur, sir, madame, mademoiselle, mon bon ami, ma bon ami, mon enfant, ma soeur, and we also find mon référent père and altesse sérénissime. These varied salutations indicate that Bourignon tailored her forms of address to the status of the recipient, which gives the letters an even greater sense of being real. This still does not, though, provide us with a sufficient answer to the question as to whether the titles, forms of address, and references to the addressees are actually genuine. The letters to Bourignon, printed at the end of Gezeugnis der Wahrheit, one of her works she first published in German, may provide a solution. I shall confine myself to a single example here. And this is a letter from Bourignon written, so the caption tells us, to a theologian in England. And it's found in La Lumière née en ténèbres, which is translated as The Light Rising in the Darkness, published in 1672. I have to close this one. Yeah. Here, find the quotation. Dear sir, your letter dated 25 December 1670 I received on 14 February, in which you write that you have written a previous one to me, which I didn't receive, nor heard word of you. And the letter is signed in the usual way, Amsterdam, 21 February 1671, your most humble servant, A.B. The letter of 25 December to which Bourignon refers here corresponds with a letter printed as Testimony 35 in Gezeugnis der Wahrheit. According to the caption, the sender, whose full name was not given, was a scholar in England in the city of London. At the bottom of the letter, aside from the place and date of writing, Checker Alley, near London, 25 December 1670, there are just two initials, R.B. And these do not, as was supposed before, stand for Richard Baxter. They are the initials of the Anglo-Irish natural philosopher Robert Boyle. Here you see the caption, scholar in England in the city of London. And then here we have Robert Boyle. It was also he who later translated one of Bourignon's works, La Solide Vertu, into English as an admirable treatise of solid virtue. In the foreword to this English edition, which appeared in 1698, so after Bourignon died, the letter of 25 December 1670, signed by R.B., is attributed to Boyle. Boyle's letter was the second he had written to Bourignon after he had heard about her from one of his Amsterdam friends, the mystic Gilliest Petrus Serrarius, in 1668. There can be no doubt that Boyle recognized something of his own religious ideas in Bourignon's writings. In any event, they caused him to seek personal contact with the author. Boyle wrote to Bourignon, telling her that he was extremely impressed by the content of her works and would very much like to translate them into English. He believed that the whole world should know about his Amateur de la Sainte Vérité et de la Vie. In the same letter, Boyle also told her about his connections with Serrarius, who had meanwhile died. At first, wrote Boyle, Serrarius had praised her to the skies, but had then revised his opinion. As a result, he had heard no more about her, and so he wrote, very curious about what had befallen her. Bourignon's response to the letter reveals how honored she felt by Boyle's interest in her and her writings. She painstakingly answered all his questions and told him what she had been doing in Amsterdam for the last year. In passing, she rebuked Serrarius. Curious, she inquired about the English translations of her books and listed those of her French and Dutch works that had meanwhile appeared in print. She also promised to send him the books he did not yet have. In short, the content and tone of the letter are entirely in keeping with Boyle's letter to her, without actually mentioning him by name. The indisputable proof of the authenticity of the letter to Boyle would of course be an autograph with address and seal. But I have been unable to trace anything of the kind. I have, though, during my research in the Bodleian and in other libraries and archives, tracked down more than 600 manuscripts of letters written by Bourignon, most of them complete with addressee, salutation and signature. Some of them are originals that were sent, still bearing the traces of the broken wax seal. Some are transcripts made on Bourignon's instructions that later served as copy, and some are copies made by disciples and probably intended for their own personal use. What's the instance with the letters in the Bodleian, I think. These letters surviving in manuscripts, all but a few of which appeared in print, are the best evidence that Bourignon's epistolary publications were the outcome of a genuine correspondence. It seems safe to conclude from this evidence that Bourignon's published letters are to a very significant extent genuine. Almost all of them were originally written in a specific situation and to a real recipient. In print, these letters took on a new life in which they were made available to a wider readership. A systematic comparison of the published letters and the manuscripts has revealed that all sorts of passages that made it possible to identify people, times and places were removed during the editing process and replaced with asterisks or NN, but that the form was left untouched. Give you an example. Here we see a letter written originally to Mr. Ort. You see it should be deleted, his name. And there are also some other parts, La Mer, on Hamburg, which should be deleted, so the new reading audience would not be able to identify the person, the addressee of the original letter. What was once a handwritten letter just remained a letter in print form, complete with date, salutation and signature. And this approach meant that the original recipients were written out of the text as far as possible and new readers could be addressed. Now, in the second part of this paper, I shall explore in greater depth the dynamic relationship between Bourignon and her readers and demonstrate how her use of the letter as a means of communication contributed to the construction of an international and supra-confessional community. The letters collected in Gezeugnis der Wahrheit, here you see the title page of that book, printed on our own printing press, provide us with extraordinarily interesting clues to the reception of her writings. They enable us to identify a specific segment of her contemporary readership and so get a look at a group that is usually concealed from the historian's view. These are the people who made personal contact with the author after reading one of her works. The fact that readers did this was not in itself unusual. What was exceptional was that this was a female writer who held no formal position of power and could in no way impose her authority, but was nonetheless approached as an authority. Each and every one of the readers who got in touch with Bourignon asserted that they had been profoundly affected by her message, which she pronounced in her works, that mankind had lost God's love and could only safeguard its salvation by following in the footsteps of Jesus Christ. This message must have come from God himself, wrote the Harlingen bootlesmaker Reinier Jansen. At the end of his first letter to Bourignon, he expressed a wish that the whole world might share in this light which God shed on mankind, quote, in the dark night to find its way, end of quote. It was quite clear, although he did not mention the title, which of Bourignon's works it was that had brought him so much joy, La Lumière née en ténèbres, The Light Rising in the Darkness, 1669. And Bourignon's second epistolary work, Le Tombeau de la Fausse Théologie, in English The Grave of False Theology, also appealed to readers. For instance, Peter Jurgens, a merchant from Friedrichstadt, told Bourignon exactly which item in this collection had most impressed him, the fifth letter in the first volume. What Bourignon argued there about rebirth was entirely of a piece with the ideas he had himself formed on the subject. The item to which Jurgens referred was a letter Bourignon had written to Comenius on 10 April 1668. His name did not, though, appear in the published version, where the recipient, Comenius, was simply described as a great theologian. Readers repeatedly asked Bourignon for her views on the ideas of other mystic and spiritualist authors, confirming that some of her readers were Christians seeking to orient themselves in a broader context or looking for a new way of giving meaning to their lives. Bourignon was asked more than once, for example, what she thought about the writings of Jacob Boehme. Several readers saw all sorts of similarities between her work and that of the Silesian mystic. Bourignon invariably dismissed the question by saying that she had not read Boehme's work. Most of the letters that Bourignon answered dealt with questions of faith or moral problems with which the correspondent concerned had been wrestling for some time. You see an example of an autograph of Bourignon's letter. So this is her own handwriting. This too is a clear indication that her readers were searching for something and that they expected Bourignon to provide answers to their questions. In her writings, as they said themselves, they found considerable assistance in fostering their own salvation. They believed that in her knowledge of the state of other souls and in her exemplary conduct, Bourignon set herself apart from the ministers who they felt had left them adrift. It was Bourignon, not the professional pastors, who was the right person to support them in the concern for the salvation of their own souls. And so the Utrecht merchant, Adriaan van Heuven, who owned almost all Bourignon's works, declared that, quote, her lessons and well-intentioned teachings were truly capable of guiding the men of goodwill to temporal and eternal bliss, end of quote. To him, Bourignon was an authority because she put the lessons of the Gospels into practice in an exemplary manner. Jan Sommerdam spoke of her writings that penetrated the soul and the marrow. They had led him to the understanding that the life of the true Christian served a single purpose, to follow the teachings of Christ. In a letter to a woman friend in Utrecht in 1674, Sommerdam went so far as to say that he would have been damned for eternity had he not, by the grace of God, found Bourignon's works and learned from them what a spiritual life entailed. He impressed upon her that Bourignon taught the true faith and showed Christians on earth the path to God's redeeming love, something that the Reformed ministers of his time were incapable of doing. Among those persons who sought contact with Bourignon through letters was a group of readers who put to her their own questions about life and death or more personal problems, so that she could tell them how they should act in these matters. A barley miller from Harlingen wanted to know whether one should, as the scriptures commanded, sell everything and give to the poor in order to become a disciple of Jesus Christ, and whether it was now time actually to do it. Another man wrote to tell her that he had married a woman who belonged to the Reformed Church. He himself was a Roman Catholic. Must he now change his religion for his wife because he had promised to do so? Sommerdam, too, was one of the readers who decided to ask Bourignon for personal advice. He approached her in April 1673 because he no longer knew which direction his life should take. He had studied medicine. Then he had devoted himself heart and soul to anatomical and entomological research, but he could not earn a living from it. Should he now, he asked Bourignon, set up in practice as a physician, or should he perhaps become an anatomist? Or might it be better to study theology? And should he wed the girl he had promised to marry? He obviously expected Bourignon to come up with the right answers to questions like these too. Others wanted more guidance from Bourignon in the form of rules of conduct. Catherine Robineau of Hamburg, for instance, asked for a rule governing the observance of holy days and prayers. She was a Roman Catholic who wrote to Bourignon in November 1672 after reading La Lumière née en ténèbres. She explained her situation in her letter. As a French woman, she felt like a stranger in Hamburg. There were no Roman Catholic clerics who could help her in the overwhelmingly Lutheran environment in which she now lived. In her new surroundings, she told Bourignon, she had not fasted for some considerable time. Others had managed to persuade her that fasting, like celebrating the feast days of the saints and of the Virgin, was an error, but Robineau was not reassured, hence her request for a rule. The information about their lives that Robineau and others confided in Bourignon leads one to suspect that most of the readers who called on her for advice were people who felt isolated spiritually or in other ways, and were tormented by uncertainty about the proper Christian way of life or moral codes. Bourignon's writings evidently gave some people in situations of alienation like these something to hold on to, while at the same time fueling a desire for more personal forms of contact. They wrote to tell Bourignon that they had come to realize that their way of life was not that of a true Christian, and that they did not have enough strength to bring about a change on their own. The desperation that can be heard in the letter from Gerrit Reins, a bargeman from Heerenveen, speaks for itself. Quote, I find no examples or pastors, and through the habit of sin have myself become estranged from the knowledge of true virtue. Oh, what to do, what to do. End of quote. Reins had, he told Bourignon in March 1672, read her polemic against the Quakers and one of her epistolary works. He clearly expected from what he had read that she would be able to tell him how, weak as he was, he could turn from the false to the true virtue. The way Brugnon is addressed and the tone of the letters in Gezeugnis der Wahrheit are evidence of the great respect in which she was held and of trust in her as a person. The fact that most of the letter writers knew her only from her writings may also have contributed to a degree of idealization. The letter Antoine Grelot, a French minister, wrote Brugnon in 1677 is a case in point. It emerges that simply and solely on the basis of her writings, he believes he has found his guru in her. The very first time he read something by her, he knew that she was of God and wholly filled with the Holy Spirit. Only she, he believed, possessed all the truth of which all the other sects or Christian religions do not have a part. Grelot had great doubts about troubling Brugnon with his problems, but at the same time he was confident that as an instrument of God she would be willing to take pity on his soul. He wrestled, he confessed, not only with his conception of his ministry, but also his two irredeemable sins, wrath and desire. So that he could in future order his life in accordance with God's will, he too wanted her to send him some rules, and he got them. Brugnon replied to his letter on the 1st of January 1678. The sense of having strayed from the Christian life was something of which most of the correspondents only became aware, so they said, through reading Brugnon's works. Dirk Bout, a Mennonite silk weaver's maid from Hamburg, wrote that her writings had opened his eyes. Thanks to Brugnon's books, Adriaan van Heuven, I mentioned him already, discovered the futility of his wretched state. And to Jelle Edes, a skipper from Harlingen, Brugnon's writings were a mirror in which he saw how far he had strayed from God. Others were convinced, even before their acquaintance with Brugnon, that they belonged to the group of reborn or true Christians. Reading her works, however, brought them to the realization that they had not yet attained that state and needed to do more than just believe and take part in church rituals. The external readers of Brugnon's books were plainly able to identify with the internal reader of her published letters. They were given criteria against which they could measure their own conscience and conduct, but at the same time they felt that they had been invited to seek personal contact with the author. And Janet Gergen Altman, author of Epistolarity, approaches to a form from which I have borrowed the distinction between external and internal readers, defines the letter, the internal readers, as, quote, a specific character represented within the world of the narrative whose reading of the letters can influence the writing of the letters. External readers, in contrast, cannot influence that writing process simply because they do not see the letters until after they have been published. In Brugnon's case, however, external readers really did play an interactive role. Her published letters prompted some of her readers to write to her in person, and these readers' letters set in train new exchanges of correspondence, which were published in their turn. The effect was a self-perpetuating stream, which goes some way towards explaining why Brugnon's oeuvre consists predominantly of letters. In short, the response from readers should not be attributed solely to the content of Brugnon's writings. The form was also an important factor. The epistolary form made their identification with the internal reader easier and at the same time created a certain intimacy between the author and the external reader. And this served to make the work more accessible and to make it easier for readers to seek contact with the author themselves. Brugnon's epistolary books were the living proof that she did not allow such responses to go unanswered. Anyone who turned to Brugnon with questions and doubts knew, in short, that they could count on a reply. While it's not always clear how the letters from readers reached Brugnon, at that time it was customary for the recipient of a letter to pay the postage. I have found no references to this in Brugnon's letters, which might mean that correspondents managed to reach her by other routes. they certainly called upon intermediaries and on more than one occasion. Robert Bull, for instance, enclosed his first letter to Bourignon in a letter to Petrus Serrarius. The letter did not, however, reach her. He gave the second to a friend who was going to Amsterdam and asked him to hand it to Bourignon in person. Pieter Arendszoon, the Amsterdam bookseller who acted as Bourignon's regular publisher from 1669 onwards, also doubtless played a role. Arends was an accessible contact for people who wanted to get in touch with her, since his address could be found in virtually all Bourignon's published works. The speed with which Bourignon responded to the questions put to her varied quite considerably. Sometimes she replied by return of post, sometimes it could be weeks or even months before she answered the letter. The speed of Bourignon's response depended on a variety of factors. To start with, for all sorts of reasons, letters sometimes took an inordinate length of time to get to her. For instance, she did not get the letter Boyle sent her on 25 December 1670 until 14 February 1671. She answered it within the week. Bourignon was by no means always able to write back straight away. However, either because she was ill quite often, or because she had no time or lacked secretarial assistance. She needed this because she preferred to dictate her letters, and also because a copy had to be made of each outgoing letter, and sometimes a translation as well if the recipient did not speak French. And conversely, incoming letters in other languages had to be translated into French before Bourignon could read them. An additional problem was that in a remote area like Lütetsburg in East Friesland, where she lived from 67 to 1680, the post was not always collected at set times in the winter month. Not everyone who wrote to Bourignon received a reply. Some letters, she said herself, she did not even open because she was not prepared to waste her valuable time reading or writing things that would bring no advantage. She did not, she informed her readers, correspond out of politeness or common civility. As a rule, she confined herself to two clearly defined categories: those who wanted to become what she called children of God, and those who disputed what she said and thus turned against the glory of God and the salvation of souls. On many occasions, she also referred readers who had asked questions and expressed doubts to her published works. There, after all, they could find everything that was important to the faith and lifestyle ideal, important to the perfection of their souls. They could find it in her published works. In many cases, people who were receptive to the faith and lifestyle ideal promulgated by Bourignon felt a need for more personal contact. Several of them wanted to see her in person and introduced themselves to her. This started as early as 1669, when Bourignon was still living in Amsterdam. Even after she moved to Schleswig-Holstein, she frequently received visits from readers who had studied her works. These encounters could give rise to lasting contacts, resulting in a conversion to an entirely new way of life. In most cases, though, physical proximity led to conflicts and disappointments, and these followers returned to the world, although they sometimes continued their correspondence. And Swammerdam was one such, it appears from his letters to Bourignon in the Bodleian Library. It was evidently easier to maintain his connection with his spiritual mother through letters, because it meant that the mother-child relationship remained essentially metaphorical. It's also telling that some people corresponded extensively with Bourignon without ever meeting her. You see an example: the Amsterdam merchant's son Johan Ort and his wife Anna Pergens, for instance, a very rich couple, actually financed the publication of a number of her works, but they never met her. And yet they, as much as Swammerdam, were part of what Bourignon herself called her community of true Christians. And I have a paragraph on the question whether we could consider Bourignon's epistolary books as a new type of religious writing compared to epistolary works of medieval mystics, female mystics, and compared to contemporaries, so 17th century contemporaries, and even compared to examples of 18th century epistolary books. But perhaps we it's better to save it for the discussion and to discuss it later on. So now I'll wind up. In conclusion, the printing press was the most important medium Bourignon employed, but contrary to what has always been assumed until now, the use of the epistolary form was not just a literary device. The hundreds of letters that survive in manuscripts prove that the letters in her epistolary books were anything but fictitious, and that they were derived from a genuine correspondence. This sheds a very different light on Bourignon herself and on her ideas. In the first place, most of Bourignon's published letters indirectly testify to the authority she was seen as having, something that has been insufficiently acknowledged in existing studies, which are too inclined to view Bourignon as a mystic who, if not completely unworldly, was certainly withdrawn from the world. Bourignon's extensive correspondence with so many people shows, however, that she lived in anything but isolation. The letters underline the communicational impact of her writings and illustrate how, after settling in Amsterdam, she was transformed from God's messenger into a spiritual leader of Christians in search of enlightenment. In the second place, the correspondence meant that Bourignon's religious ideas were shaped to a significant degree in the dialogue with her readers. This form of communication also meant that Bourignon was always addressing different people in her epistolary books, and this variety of recipients explains the polyphony of sometimes conflicting voices we hear in her work. At one moment in her letters, she is the mother reprimanding her child. At the next, she is the angry author replying to curious readers, or the hunted and persecuted subject begging the favor of the magistrate or the sovereign. In other words, it was the people to whom the letters were originally addressed who largely determined the content, form and style of the epistolary publications and the way that Bourignon represented herself. In fact, Bourignon's epistolary books acted as mediators between self and public, without her having to exhibit herself in public as the mouthpiece of God, unlike, say, the 17th century female prophets active in England at the time of the Civil War, in order to convince her public of her authenticity. And in the third place, it is clear that Bourignon's letters and treatises were an important part of the process of establishing a group that began in 1669. It was, after all, primarily her epistolary books that encouraged readers to try to get in touch with the author. At the same time, exchanges of letters were an important means of binding followers to her. Since Bourignon increasingly avoided face-to-face meetings after a series of conflicts with followers, the handwritten letter was her main means of building up and maintaining her spiritual network. In this way, she created her own international supra-confessional community, which admittedly was much smaller and less egalitarian than a scholarly network like that of the Republic of Letters, but was also less elitist. It was, in short, thanks primarily to the shrewd use of the letters as a means of communication that Bourignon became one of the few women in the 17th century to succeed in attracting a large group of followers and giving her spiritual leadership form and content. Thank you very much.